I do think that that's one of the most important things, is you got to figure out how to separate your success from the success of the business.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Will Ahmed is the founder and CEO of Whoop, which has developed next-generation wearable technology for optimizing human performance and health. Ahmed founded Whoop with a background in collegiate athletics, where he realized the detriment of overtraining and the importance of recovery. Today, Whoop members range from professional athletes and Fortune 500 CEOs to fitness enthusiasts and executives to military personnel and healthcare workers. Ahmed was recently named to the 2020 Fortune 40 Under 40 healthcare list and previously named to Forbes 30 Under 30 and Boston Business Journal 40 Under 40. In 2020, Whoop was named Fast Company's most innovative company for wellness. I got to sit down with Will late last week to discuss Whoop and really the state of wellness in general. Of course, I wanted to start with his own personal story, his background in fitness and sports, and why that led to Whoop.
I was always into sports and exercise. I think I played on maybe a dozen different sports teams when I was 8 or 10 years old. And I ended up playing squash competitively in college. I was captain of the Harvard squash team. And the experience of being a college athlete led me, I think, further down this rabbit hole of health and fitness. So college athletes are training 3 or 4 hours a day. And I was someone who used to overtrain. So you go through this period of getting fitter and fitter and fitter. And then all of a sudden you kind of fall off a cliff. And for me, it was really figuring out why I overtrained. What could I measure about my body to better understand my body? And I was surprised, frankly, that there was nothing really out there to do that. This is in 2010, 2011. Maybe I'm a sophomore or junior in college. I've overtrained a couple times. Other athletes are undertraining, getting injured, misinterpreting fitness peaks, not necessarily understanding the importance of sleep or recovery. So that's what led me down this rabbit hole of physiology research. And I read something like 500 medical papers while I was in school.
Wow.
And yeah. And I guess
you did go to Harvard. So I figure might not even be much for you.
I did go down that rabbit hole. And I ended up writing a paper myself on how to continuously understand the human body. And that effectively became the business plan for Whoop. And I think alongside all the physiology research, I, for a long time, believed that technology was going to naturally move from being on your desk to being on your lap to being in your pocket to being on your body and eventually in your body. And I thought that that evolution of computing was going to transform health. So the combination of, I think, realizing that there were certain things you could measure that could really unlock your body, and this idea that computing was going to keep getting smaller and smarter, that gave me the confidence to start Whoop when I was 22 years old.
Right. And at the time you started, I mean, you're saying 2010, right? Like professional sports, I mean, $1 billion business in 2010, billions still. And are you saying there was nothing out there that was taking into account with all these athletes, something that they could utilize that would really do what Whoop is now doing for so many just individuals?
Oh yeah. And not only was there nothing there, the coaches and the athletes weren't even asking for it. I mean, that was the crazy thing. Like when I knew I was going to start Whoop, I actually went and met with a bunch of coaches because our first market was sports. And I said to them, you know, if you could have any technology, what would you want it to do? And they always came back to exercise, training, games. They wanted to have better video analysis, sweat analysis, GPS data, acceleration data, location on the field data. Like it was always about more information as it related to practice or training or games. But when I asked them, what are your problems? They always came back to availability, athletes not being ready, athletes being injured, overtrained. And so I thought there was a real mismatch between the solutions they were asking for and the problems they were facing. And this is a pretty good insight for any entrepreneur listening to this. Customers tend to be very good at describing their problems. They tend to be less good at describing the solutions to those problems.
Yeah, I love that.
And so for me, it was thinking that sports in 2010, health and fitness in 2010, the pendulum had swung way too far towards more is more. Can you exercise twice a day? Can you exercise three times a day? More strength lifting, more running, more distance, whatever. People forget weightlifting really only started in like the 90s, right? So this is only 20 years later, right? And I realized that the next chapter in sports, and by the way, health broadly speaking, was going to be around sleep and it was going to be around recovery. And in fact, I believed in 2010 that sleep and recovery were more important to performance than exercise. And that was a pretty contrarian point of view that I think has now largely turned out to be right.
Yeah, 100%. Not a professional athlete, but I'm totally into health and wellness. I've started lifting weights actually not too far from kind of where you launched the business on Lansdowne Street at Gold's Gym there. I don't even know if it's still around. There was no one thinking about recovery. And then I started running Ironmans and races, and it was just no one. And to me, it's so amazing that you're saying 2010 and people not realizing this, which was incredible. And did you first figure this out when you actually wrote that paper? Was that really the basis of saying, whoa, this is what everyone's missing here and should be focusing on?
It started with my personal experience, right? Like I thought that if I worked the hardest at practice, it didn't really matter what else I did. Because I had gotten my time in at practice, I was going to get fitter. And it was such a naive way of thinking about training, right? And the reality is you have to demonstrate good health. You have to demonstrate fitness 24/7 to be healthy or fit, right? Not 3 hours a day. And so as a college athlete, I would exercise really hard. And then maybe I'd stay up late. Maybe I'd go party. Maybe I just wasn't taking, I was just fence, right? And so as a result, I was someone who wasn't recovering properly. And as a result, that's probably why I overtrained. So that was my personal experience. And then the physiology research was eye-opening because it showed me that there were key physiological indicators that you could measure that would actually tell you the status of your body. The most profound being this statistic called heart rate variability, which in the last 10 years has become much more popular, but in 2010 was completely unknown, really. And the medical research that I read on it was fascinating. I mean, here's a statistic, heart rate variability, that was being used by Olympic powerlifters in the 80s to determine how much weight they should be lifting. It was being used by the best cyclists in the world to determine how many miles they should train. It was being used by the CIA for lie detection tests. It was being used by cardiologists to predict if someone was going to have a heart attack. And I was like, how have I never heard of this statistic? Why isn't everyone measuring this? Oh, because you need a $50,000 piece of medical equipment that's sitting in a hospital somewhere, the electrocardiogram. So the first question I said to myself was, wow, if you could get that technology in a much better form factor and collect it on an individual seamlessly, that would really be a breakthrough. I mean, you'd be able to tell someone a lot about their body if you could just do that. And, you know, I went down this rabbit hole of sleep, and I realized that my understanding of sleep was incredibly naive. It wasn't just how much time you spent in bed, but it was, in fact, the amount of time really that you spent in slow wave and REM sleep. That's really the only amount of sleep that matters. So if you ask someone how much sleep they got last night, who doesn't measure their sleep, they'll say, I went to bed at 11, I woke up at 6, I got 7 hours of sleep. In reality, they spent 7 hours in bed. And within that 7 hours, they spent time awake, in light sleep, in slow wave sleep, and in REM sleep. Awake and light, you get virtually no value out of. REM and slow wave, that's where all the magic happens. I mean, REM sleep is where your mind is repairing cognitively. That's when you are in a deep dreaming state. And everyone needs that to be able to perform at a high cognitive level. Slow wave sleep is when your body produces about 95% of its human growth hormone. So this idea that you get stronger in the gym or I got stronger at practice, no. You're actually breaking your muscles down to repair them later during slow wave sleep. You actually get stronger during slow wave sleep. So let's go back to the person who goes to bed at 11 and wakes up at 6. Of that 7 hours they spend in bed, they may have gotten only 30 minutes of REM and slow wave, or they may have gotten 6 hours of REM and slow wave. And by the way, the person who got 30 minutes versus the person who got 6 hours, these are completely different people. They're living completely different lives. They're performing at completely different levels. And so when I fully appreciated that, and I'm a competitive person, I said to myself, well, gosh, I wonder how much REM and slow wave I'm getting. Like, how can I get more of that? Because it's not even just, oh, spend more time in bed. It's like, how can you make the time that you're spending sleeping more effective? So those were some of the immediate things that just jumped off the page to me. And so from there, you're off for the races.
So tell me about getting off to the races. What was that like? Because this, I assume, was the first business you've built, aside from maybe trading cards as a kid or what, you know, most entrepreneurs did something. But what was that like and how did you go about it?
Well, not only was it the first business I started, it was the first full-time job I ever had. So really new to it all. I think first and foremost, you have to have great partners, great people involved in anything you're creating. And ideally, those people are complementary to you. So if it's not obvious, what Whoop does is deeply technical. And my background isn't deeply technical. I mean, sure, I've done a lot of research on stuff and I'm a curious guy, but we do pretty hardcore computer science, data science, algorithm development, engineering, hardware development. So I needed to build out that side of the team. I was fortunate to meet John Capitolupo, who became our chief technology officer, math and computer science whiz, father, actually a professor of exercise physiology, Aurelia Nicolai, really the third banana of the three of us in building this business. He was a talented mechanical engineer at Harvard. And so the three of us were really the founders of this thing out of the gates. And mind you, I was taking kind of the business and research point of view on it. Hey, here's how we can build the business. Here's what it needs to be able to measure. John really had the technical chops around algorithm development, computer science. So the software, how to think about what the algorithms would need to be on the hardware. And then you had Aurelian who was able to sort of think through the hardware. And that's a lot of responsibility for three people. I mean, now we've got maybe 300 people that are responsible for just those four things that I've said. But in the early days, you know, you have to learn how to do it all yourself. And the beautiful thing about starting a business or becoming an entrepreneur is it reveals in great transparency all your strengths and weaknesses, right? And your holes and what you need to improve. And so the key for those, at least for me, was trying to find people to fill in those gaps. The things that you didn't know how to do, try to go recruit someone to do them. And that becomes pretty critical. I think one other thing I learned in the early days, maybe not, I didn't learn this in the early days, but I can learn, I understand it now looking back on it, is this importance of really only comparing yourself to yourself. I think there's a temptation for entrepreneurs and maybe especially young entrepreneurs to compare themselves to very successful entrepreneurs who have already done it. We're a four-person company and gosh, I can't hire the fifth person. And I bet Steve Jobs never had to deal with this, like this super, sort of a super unhelpful attitude. And it's unhelpful really for two reasons. One is that I bet you when these really well-performing or high-performing entrepreneurs first started their business, they actually didn't know all that much more than you did. And the second is that the key, and it's how they became who they became, is they grew into it. They kept learning and evolving and growing, and they focused probably on themselves in that process. So for me, it was learning to effectively separate my identity from that of the business. And I think that, again, when you first start a company, you tie your performance up very directly with the company's performance. And in that, if the business is doing well, you're succeeding. If the business is failing, you're failing. And I think that you have to focus on how you're growing personally, independent from what the business is doing. And if you can really do that, then it almost doesn't matter what happens to the business in the long, long run, because you will have figured out all your strengths and weaknesses and you'll be ready to do the next thing.
I love that. I love that you brought that up. As an entrepreneur myself, having building businesses, selling businesses, on a third startup right now, it's amazing how much sometimes I equate my self-worth, even after having successes, with the success of the business. And it means not like, and I'll tell you from the people we've had on this show, last week, the co-founder of Netflix and Arthur Blank, they all, the same situation you had. And what I love about this, that we all went through, it's like you're sitting there with three people, and I would always think of, oh, Netflix or Apple, like you said, and like they didn't have any issues. And what I love about this show is every single person I talk to goes through the same situation where basically they were, especially the ones in terms of just general startups, ideas, and especially in your city, like this was the first thing you've done. So it wasn't like you went out and did this and people are probably throwing millions and millions of dollars at you. You really had to kind of prove yourself. And it's so hard to sit in that situation where you just are equating your self-worth to like how well the business does. And then there's no benefit to it. And I want to ask for you, how have you gotten over that? Have you, I mean, you guys have had some great success, so it must feel good. But like, have you been personally able to get over that?
I think like some level of insecurity or, you know, even being self-deprecating can help make you build a better business, right? Because you're constantly, you're kind of constantly paranoid about what are ways that you can be better? What are things that you're not doing effectively? At least those are sort of things I'm always asking myself in a somewhat neurotic way. You know, you're kind of asking yourself, how can this be better? How can I do a better job? What am I missing? What am I missing? So that's the closest thing that comes to mind. But I do feel that I am very focused on how can I make the business success and how can I be successful? And I do really view those as two separate things. And I've seen this all the time where I've gotten to meet a lot of other entrepreneurs, founders, and the business even could be doing very well. And the founder, you can tell, is failing, right? You can tell that they're not in control of the moment, even if the business is doing well. And on the flip side, I've seen founders whose business had all kinds of, you know, were really troubled businesses, you know, for product market fit reasons or whatever. And the entrepreneur was able to roll through it and figure it out or not, but come out the other side. And so I do think that that's one of the most important things is you got to figure out how to separate your success from the success of the business.
I love that because it's so true and so apparent and just personally and people I've talked to. And when you look at it from the outside, there's someone who would look at you and, oh my God, this guy's the founder of Whoop. You know, like everything must be easy, perfect. He's doing incredible. And then you realize like there is a difference between the business success, personal success. And if you could have both, that's what's amazing. And that's why I love what your product is because it really focuses on health and wellness and you need those things to actually really feel good and do things. So when you were going back to those early days when it was the three of you or four of you, were there a lot of issues? Was it hard? Were there days you were just like, I don't know if we should continue with the business?
I think I always had a pretty blind commitment to the business. I never doubted the vision. I never doubted the potential, but there were a lot of challenges along the way. And most of the challenges were driven by our own ambition. We chose to build everything ourselves from scratch. The hardware, the software, the analytics, designing it across a bunch of platforms. And it's just a really hard space. I mean, you have to be great at like five or six things in order to be successful in wearable technology. And there's a reason that so many companies have failed in this space. It's just an incredibly hard space. And so those early days, I think what was hard was having so many people disagree with us. And again, this is in part why I feel like my identity got tied up in the business too. I hadn't really done anything professionally outside of start this company. And every person I met was giving me reasons for why I should do it differently or why I shouldn't do it at all or why this initial market was the wrong market. We should go into that market or why they weren't going to invest in the company. I mean, it really felt like an endless, like just constantly running into brick walls. And you look back on it fondly, but it's hard in the time. And I'll say this. I mean, I think founding successful company, it's much harder than you think it'll end up being, but it's not nearly as hard as everyone tells you it's going to be, which for the most part is impossible, right? Like the number of people that told me what I was trying to do was impossible. I mean, it's probably 1,000 people told me that. I'm not even exaggerating. Like you're just going to fail if you try to do it this way, Will. The number of times I heard that is crazy to think about. And so you build up a bit of a blind stubbornness to that along the way. And it actually, it took work to sort of tear that wall down, because for a long time when you find that you're sort of, you create conviction as a form of, it's like a coping mechanism to develop your thing. Because if you listen to too much of that feedback, it's actually pretty hard to get through your day. But then later you realize that now it's starting to work, or things are coming together. And now you need to bring that disagreement in. You need to actually figure out where really might there be gaps in the way you're thinking. Where are the holes? And that's an interesting transition too.
Yeah, it's hard, because I find one of the hardest parts of being an entrepreneur, and I think one of the best attributes or the number one attribute of all the people I've interviewed over the past 2 years that had made them successful, was because they've been told, no, this isn't going to work. It's the persistence and the ability to get off the mat. And for so many people, myself for sure, if one or two people were to tell me, no, that's never going to work, or this, I'm competitive, but it starts creeping in your mind. And I just think of all those entrepreneurs, especially ones listening to the show, who like the first no, like they turned it off. And then you look at a guy like yourself, who you just said went through thousands of those, right? Thousands of those. And now you look where you are. And to me, it just shows me again, it's persistence and being able to get by that negativity. And now I'm sure anything you say to anyone is like, oh, genius, great idea. That's going to do, you know, incredible, right? But you did say something that was really interesting, that was like, how do you fill in the spots when people tell you where things that might really not work, not the whole concept and idea, and how do you figure those out, right? That to me, how have you been able to do that now, especially at this stage?
Well, I think as you get more comfortable in the role, as you get more confident in running a business, you start to really welcome disagreement, and you look at disagreement as a way of figuring out, why do I feel so strongly about this? Why do I think I know the right answer? What am I missing? And normally through that process of discovery, you do realize that there's a different way to think about it, or a better solution that's somewhere between the one that you and the person you're disagreeing with are describing. And that kind of friction, I think, creates magic. So yeah, I think now I spend most of my days being disagreed with, but in a productive way, you know, in an exciting way, not in a threatening way. I think, again, that's the importance too of pulling yourself out of the business, is when you're describing this business and it's this thing you've created, and there's not a lot else to show for it, and someone's telling you it's going to fail, again, your identity feels too tied up in it. And so it's hard to sort of embrace that disagreement, if you will, right? Whereas now it's much easier to embrace.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors. How much money are you paying in interest on your credit cards every month? Too much. Then why not consolidate your credit cards into just one payment at a lower fixed rate and start saving money? It's easy with a credit card consolidation loan from LightStream. Rates start at just 5.95% APR with auto pay and excellent credit. LightStream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. And now, just for my listeners, you can apply now and get a special interest rate discount and save even more. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/HSH. That's lightstream.com/HSH. Subject to credit approval, rates range from 5.95% APR to 19.99% APR, and include a 0.50% auto pay discount. Lowest rate requires excellent credit. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/HSH for more information.
And our next sponsor.
So, who's been in this pickle? To win your next big customer, you need to know your technology will perform the way you want it to, even under an enterprise workload. That the cloud infrastructure supporting that performance won't buckle under the strain. But without that big customer, enterprise cloud is priced out of reach. Well, not anymore. Oracle for Startups delivers enterprise cloud at a startup price tag with free cloud credits and 70% off industry-leading cloud services to help you reel in the big fish confidently. And with multi-cloud support and no vendor lock-in, you're free to keep building in any way you choose. Your partnerships should be assets, not roadblocks to your success. To learn more, visit oracle.com/go-to/HSH. That's oracle.com/go-to/HSH. And we're back. So tell me, I mean, in terms, when was that first moment where you were like, wow, what we're doing here, this is going to be successful? Like, have you had that moment? Or like, you know, was there a moment where you were just like, I think we really, this is really going to work?
One very cool moment, I think it was late 2014, maybe early 2015. I was watching basketball on television. And at this point, there's probably 100 whoop straps in the world. And I turned on, we were watching basketball, and I see this Kia commercial with LeBron James in it. And in the Kia commercial, LeBron James is wearing a whoop strap. I was sitting with my parents, and I was like, look, it's a whoop. He's wearing a whoop. And I was like, I told you he's wearing a whoop. And that was pretty cool because it meant that LeBron James was so hooked on his whoop strap that he wouldn't even take it off during a Kia commercial. So that to me was invigorating, you know, at a time when we didn't really have revenue or anything else. And we're building this thing that no one's ever heard of, having one of the best athletes of all time. Wearing it was pretty encouraging. And we had Michael Phelps wearing it around that time too. And so it was, there were always these signs that we were building the right thing, but man, it was hard to turn into a whole business on top of that.
Yeah, that's so cool. When, I mean, that just is a moment when you're like, wow, it's got to be incredible. So tell me, for Whoop now and in for the future, and again, like, it's so amazing to me that people just start realizing like how important recovery is and taking care of yourself. But what is the goal with the product, and what is the goal in terms of the brand and getting out there? What do you want to accomplish besides putting a Whoop on everyone's wrist? Are there other areas you want to go into?
Well, our mission at Whoop is to unlock human performance. And essentially, that means we believe that every individual has an inner potential that you can tap into if you can better understand their bodies. And what makes Whoop unique, I think, from any other product on the market, is that if you wear Whoop, you will change behavior and you will improve your health. And I think that's a really hard but really important thing to do, is to change behavior and improve health. And we do a lot of that through daily coaching in the app, you know, telling people to exercise a certain amount or sleep more or go to bed at a specific time or change certain things about their lifestyle and their behavior. We'll explain whether diets are working or supplements are working or certain workouts are working or not. And you can create teams with friends and things like that. So there's a whole community aspect. So a lot of it is, I think, doubling down on that layer of coaching and insights, essentially helping you figure out what are the two or three things that you need to change or know to be a healthier, better person? It's amazing to me the messages I get every day from Whoop members who have figured out something about their bodies that they've changed and unlocked that they never knew. And I think that the potential of wearable technology is truly to profoundly improve people's health. And in the long run, probably dramatically change the healthcare system as well. Because the problem with the healthcare system is that preventative costs are cheap, curative costs are really expensive. And if you can move things from being curative to being preventative, that's where all the magic happens. And that's where I think wearable technology can play a massive role.
Yeah, you guys, so going back to when starting the business and getting out there, I assume you realized, when was it where, hey, if we're going to be able to do what we want to do, we're going to have to raise a lot of money? Because I know you guys have raised a ton of money. So there's a lot of people who believe in you now, the idea. But how, tell me about that, when you knew you needed this and how you went about it.
I think capital raising, like anything, is a skill that you get into. I mean, the first 725 grand I raised was harder than the $100 million round we just did a couple months ago.
Yeah.
I'm not even kidding.
No, I believe it.
Literally, it was much harder to raise $725,000 than it was to just raise $100 million recently. And I say that because it reflects a couple of things. One, raising capital is based on the stage that you're at as a business. And two, raising capital is based on the stage that you're at as an entrepreneur and how many times and reps you've done it. When I was first raising capital, I think I've made a lot of the mistakes that probably most entrepreneurs make. Spending a lot of time with an investor who's probably never going to write a check. You're now on the 8th or 9th meeting. Guess what? You can find someone completely new and get them over the line faster than you can get that person over the line. That person never writes the check. It's having a coherent narrative. It's really knowing what you're going to do with the capital. It's also having good alignment. You don't actually want capital from every investor you meet.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
You have to make sure that they're investing the capital for the same reasons that you want to take it. Which I think is so fundamental and maybe often overlooked even at the early stage. At the early stage, there's a little bit of a feeling of desperation, I think, if you're a first-time founder, like, I really need this money. And so you kind of could end up taking capital from the wrong investors. And raising capital from someone is like getting married, but you can't get divorced. I mean, they're there for a long time.
Yeah, forever. Or until you sell.
Yeah, you want to get that right.
So how helpful have you raised $100 million, probably a lot of different investors. Aside from the dollars, how helpful have these investors been for you and for the business?
I think at different stages, you have to have different types of investors. I mean, that sounds fairly obvious, but it all comes down to whether or not your business has product market fit yet or not. And if it doesn't have product market fit, which is to say that it's clear that there's a group of people that are willing to pay for your product or your service. If it doesn't have that yet, you really want to be identifying investors that are willing to take on a lot of risk, that are really focused on technology development or service development, whatever it takes to get to that stage of product market fit, because really nothing else matters until you build something that people want to buy. And those people need to have a higher risk appetite. They could definitely lose their money, right? Like, and you want to make sure that you have a pretty similar vision on what you're going to build with that capital. And for Whoop, like, that was maybe the first 5 years of the company was really getting the technology to a place where it wasn't completely embarrassing and having people love using it. And then the second phase of investor is, okay, you've got product market fit. How do you scale this thing? And that starts to be more about scaling from a marketing standpoint, scaling from a team standpoint, making sure your culture doesn't fall apart, making sure you're growing into the role of being, you know, being CEO of a 25-person, 50-person company is different than being CEO of a, I don't know, I think today we're 375 people. So how are you evolving with that? So that's a little bit how I've seen our investor base evolve. And your board of directors hopefully reflects that evolution as well. We've had some turnover on our board from the earlier investors kind of passing the hats to the later investors. And I think all of that's a natural and healthy evolution.
Yeah. How's that been for you going from, you know, like you talked about your three guys trying to put something together, 20 employees, now 375. Are you doing things you might not want to be doing now? Or are you doing things you actually always wanted to be doing? For you personally, how has that change in the number of people now within the business affected you day to day?
I find it completely exhilarating. I think, like, in a lot of ways, I found it harder probably being, you know, managing 25 people. I think that was a time where I was really struggling with growing into the role. We'd raised probably millions of dollars even at that stage, and maybe the business wasn't far along, or I felt like I wasn't doing enough good enough job. So this goes back to sort of that early realization that I had that it was going to be important for me to be growing, independent from how the business was. And some of that goes back to Whoop type stuff, your lifestyle decisions, the things you prioritize, the relationships in your life. I really believe all that stuff makes a big impact on your performance. And today I think I have a good handle on that stuff. And for those reasons, my point is I feel more comfortable in the role today, even managing more people and probably a, you know, more responsibility because I've grown into it. Whereas at that stage, I hadn't even grown into it at that stage. And so that's again, you just have to focus on your own growth, I think.
Yeah. You're in such a fascinating space. And I think we've seen so much change come about in terms of technology and wearables, and all of the major players have dabbled. And you said it at the beginning. I loved how you phrased it, kind of like, where eventually it's going to be like in your body, right? Like it's just going to be in your body. And that was, which I completely believe, not just in your clothes and your arm, but like, where do you see in terms of the future? And I know it moves quick, but where do you see kind of that intersection of technology, sports, and now even going through COVID, like the future of healthcare?
It's a really good question. I think first and foremost, I believe wearable technology can truly change the world from a standpoint of health and behavior. I think that if you look at the healthcare system today, the fact that you go get a checkup on a random day of the year and you walk into a doctor's office and they stick a pulse oximeter on your finger to take your resting heart rate, it's such an antiquated system. It's crazy. I joke sometimes, like, I've got 5 years of this heart rate data if you want to look at that too.
yeah, I can imagine you going to the doctor and getting your...
I don't go to the doctor that often. But it doesn't make any sense. You should go to the doctor 15 minutes before you need to be there. And you should get an alert that tells you you need to go see a doctor right now. And frankly, we've had people on Whoop who say it saved their lives because they had some real irregularity. And they want to go see a doctor immediately, or they went into an emergency room. And so it's going to change every aspect of the healthcare system. And the reason it's so powerful is because it's going to start with the individual taking responsibility of themselves. If every individual got a little bit better sleep, made slightly better lifestyle decision, got a little more exercise, or got the right amount of exercise relative to how much they've rested, life expectancies, society's happiness, diseases, obesity. I mean, a lot of these things would start getting solved. I mean, it's crazy just how little changes can have such a profound impact.
It is amazing. You wonder why insurance companies certainly lower premiums for people that are healthy, fit, exercise. It's such knowledge. And what I love what you guys are doing, not just about, like you said in the beginning, you'd kill yourself, you know, when you were captain of the squash team, like you just, but about the recovery, the sleep, the total wellness package, which I love what you said. Like, how good did that make you feel when you heard like some of your users be like, if I wasn't wearing this, or I, you know, I could be dead right now. That's got to be bigger than to me. I mean, like just even like getting $100 million in funding, or at least close.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've definitely found that I am most motivated by the impact that the technology is having. You don't really know, at least I didn't know what I was going to be most motivated by as it gets more successful. But for me, it's how many of those stories can we have? And that's pretty motivating, right? We saw this also in 2020 and more recently with COVID-19, where we did a lot of research around COVID-19. We started doing research on COVID-19 in January of 2020. So we were early to the game. By early March, we were the first consumer app to have COVID-19 tracking in the Whoop app. And by the end of March, we had over 2,000 people report having tested positive for COVID-19. So very quickly, we had one of the largest data sets for what COVID-19 looked like before, during, and after getting the illness. And we partnered with CQU and Cleveland Clinic, two leading research institutions, and by the summer had published peer-reviewed research showing that an elevated respiratory rate could be a predictor of COVID-19. Now, respiratory rate is the number of breaths you have in a minute, and it's normally somewhere between 10 and 20 breaths per minute. And we were able to show that your baseline, which really never changes, if it had a meaningful increase, it might be a sign that you had COVID-19, even if you don't feel it. The study showed that an elevated respiratory rate could catch about 80% of cases, which isn't perfect, but is probably a lot better than nothing. And it's been amazing the number of stories I've heard about people seeing an elevated respiratory rate on Whoop and realizing because of that, they shouldn't go to work or they shouldn't go see their grandparent. And that's an amazing story. I remember this one vividly. This guy said, I saw an elevated respiratory rate. I felt fine. I was supposed to go see my grandparents for Thanksgiving and I didn't go. And sure enough, I tested positive for COVID-19. So, you know, it's stories like that that are really heartwarming. But again, they go back to this potential that we were talking about, where you've got human beings measuring things they can't feel, and that's driving them, that's helping them change their behavior, and it's helping create positive outcomes.
Yeah, change their behavior. And, you know, what everyone always says is, you know, I'd rather live a life where I feel healthy and I feel good, as opposed to a long life where you have so many struggles and so many issues. And it just seems like with Whoop, it's the exact tool that can really help you, because you said something that I totally agree with. And to me, if this happens and you push through with it, which it seems like it's happening, like, you should know, I need to go see a doctor in 15 minutes. Not, I'm here for my daily checkup, whatever it might be. Because once you give people through your product that opportunity to know when to go and know when to do something, that is going to change their wellness and their life and their just general being more than anything I could imagine.
And look, that's where this is going. There's no question, Robert, that in our lifetimes, you're going to get alerts for needing to go see a doctor. And those are going to save lives. There's no question. And I think in some ways, because like version one of wearable technology came across as being a little dumb, that people actually don't realize how fast this is coming. And it's really exciting to be on the side of building it, because it's going to blow people away, I think.
Yeah. What's your thoughts just in terms of this technology? And it just seems to me, this is so much bigger, Whoop, than athletes and people in fitness. I mean, this is really, this is for everyone. Right? Like, I can't imagine who, no matter who you are, you would imagine that this is something, this is a technology and a wearable you want to be using. Is that how you see the future of the business?
We definitely see the future of the business as improving health for everyone. I think today the product does a really good job serving anyone who's motivated at all in their life. The person who's sitting on the couch and doesn't want to get off the couch, I don't know if we're ready for that person yet. But we'll get to that person. But that's a hard person, right? Because in a lot of ways, Whoop is a 24/7 life coach. And so if you don't want to be coached, that's a hard challenge. But for anyone who's motivated in their lives, whether it's motivated to get fitter or lose weight or get a promotion even, Whoop's going to find ways to dial you up a little bit, to get you a little bit more competitive with yourself, to sort of unlock just a couple of things, and then you'll be amazed. And so that's a powerful feeling today that we've built that technology.
Yeah, listen, I love what you've done, what you've built. I really think there's seldom do I do podcasts with a lot of great entrepreneurs, successful entrepreneurs, but this truly is can and will and is really changing the world for people that they live in. It's the most important thing. You know, when anyone ever says like health is wealth, or thank God you have your health, right? It's the most important thing there is. And eventually, I'm sure those guys on the couch, when it hits them, or they, you know, they have a heart attack or whatever it is, they, most of them want to get healthy, right? And it's just such a great thing, Will, that you're doing. And God bless you for sticking with it and never listening to those 1,000 people that told you no. It's a great example for a lot of people in our audience who are starting businesses, have businesses. So I really wanted to thank you for coming on How Success Happens.
No, thank you. Thanks a lot for having me. Big fan of the podcast.
Appreciate it, man. Thanks so much.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.